Welcome to This Is Money in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lamb and I today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up with all the shenanigans in Westminster this week, you could be forgiven for failing to register. Well, we even had a spring statement at all, let alone clocked its finer points. Well, fear not, Simon and Lee are here to fill you in on what you may have missed, including the true reach of the penny-pinching exchequer, a victory over death tax, more criticism for the LISA, bye-bye boilers, and are we heading for a solar panel eclipse? All that and plenty more coming up. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. For a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little. Give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.
But first, what a week in politics. I promise, though, we're not going to be talking about Brexit more than is absolutely necessary. No, instead, we're going to be focusing on the slightly less dramatic, if I can call it that, spring statement that we got. The first opportunity in the year for the Chancellor to stand up, tell us all what's going on with the country's finances, any plans he may have, and where we're all heading. And after this week, good luck with that one. But now, before we get into the nitty-gritty, a very quick headline assessment, if you would, guys, of the content and, dare I say it, the colour of the statement. Was it all fireworks, excitement and rabbits out of the hat, Lee?
No.
OK, right, that is a headline. A very short one. Do you want to add a sub-headline to that?
It was a very difficult time in which to deliver a spring statement in what has been a pretty bonkers week in Westminster with a number of votes around Brexit going on. You can see why the spring statement kind of lost its pizzazz of recent year over the last sort of decade or so. We've seen these statements revealing all sorts of rabbits out of the hat and all sorts of exciting products and schemes and things that have come out, that have been launched, that have been headline grabbing. This was very much a kind of Chancellor who really just, he got quite wordy. It was quite boring, a bit dull, if I'm being honest with you. But, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. And at the moment, we still were kind of unsure how Brexit's going to unfold, but it's okay because we've got ages. We've got 2 weeks.
It was
a muted affair.
If that's the case, then, Simon, it begs the question, why did they bother? Why now? What did we learn?
Well, the idea behind the spring statement is to update us on the nation's finances. Mm-hmm. And that was the idea behind the forerunner of the spring statement, which was called the autumn statement. But the autumn statement and the budget were swapped. So now we have a spring statement and an autumn budget. Are you keeping up here? But what happened is, down the years, the autumn statement got a bit twisted and turned into a mini budget. So mm-hmm. we've become used to effectively having pretty much two budgets a year. A number of chancellors have pledged that they're going to stop doing this and promptly gone back on their words and not actually managed to deliver on it. But this time around, Philip Hammond stuck to his guns, stood up, bored the pants off everyone for about 25 minutes with just this very, very long stream of words,
right.
Chucked a couple of gags in, even a couple of risque Brexit-related ones, then sat down. And then John McDonnell stood up and shouted at him for a bit. And then he sat down and we got back onto the important business of causing absolute chaos for the country.
OK, but we won't talk about the absolute chaos for the country. We'll talk about that super exciting 25 minutes, because I'm sure there were some things in the very wordy statement that were relatively relevant to us. Alongside the spring budget, of course, we get the forecast for the Office of Budgetary Responsibility. So let's head there first. Before we drill down into the main issues, though, you have absolutely highlighted, both of you, what on earth can we predict going forward when we don't even know what's going to happen in the next 2 weeks? How are they working this stuff out? Because we had things like income growth, some good news there, interest rates, the pound, household borrowing, house prices. How on earth can any organisation work out a forecast in this environment?
Well, first of all, I'll say with the OBR, we picked through the OBR document, which basically gives a lot of a snapshot of what's going on with the economy and alongside a lot of other things, bits and pieces in there. Now, it's meant to be an independent body that kind of looks at this and crunches the figures. It was set up in 2010 to sort of have a look at what was sort of happening with the budget and giving it a sort of like independent look to see what was going on. Now, what we saw in that document and what we picked through once we got over Philip Hammond's quite dull speech was actually a lot of revisions. There was quite a lot of revisions in there from the budget last year. And what that meant was there were things that didn't quite look as good as they did in October because the goalposts have shifted. Probably in October, there was more optimism around there was going to be a Brexit with a deal. We're now teetering on the brink of a no-deal Brexit or a delay in Brexit or no Brexit at all. It's a very uncertain outlook. And what that's meant is the revisions of these statements from just 6 months ago has been quite drastic. So, for example, if you're looking at interest rates now and what's going to happen to interest rates in the next 5 years, the forecast now is that they'll barely be above 1% in 5 years. So what that means, essentially, is interest rates look like they're going to be pretty much stuck where they are for the next 5 years, if you go on the OBR's word and what it says in there. And that is a slight revision on what it was saying back in October. The pound, OBR now saying that the pound just won't recover in the next 5 years against the major currencies that it trades against. It's obviously a worry for anyone that's going on holiday. We're already seeing the pound in your pocket going nowhere near as far as it did before the Brexit vote. Household borrowing, there was an update in there saying that we're not going to borrow as much. That's a little chink of silver light. This is how much you put on credit cards, personal loans, that sort of thing. The statement before, so in October 2018, it wasn't that long ago. We're talking literally 5 or 6 months ago. They were saying it was going to, in the next 5 years, the line was going up quite sharply and it was going towards financial crisis levels, the amount of people were going to borrow. That's been revised right back, probably because of household sentiment, people worried about taking out credit, because we're not too sure how this Brexit is going to unfold. House prices, one of your favourite subjects, I know, Georgie. It was trickling along 3-4% growth every year. That's what they predicted in October. Now they're saying this year that it's going to drop. There's going to be a drop off in house prices. It's going to dip into negative territory, very slightly negative territory towards the end of the year before recovering again next year. But it's not looking as rosy as it was for house prices. And income growth, actually, there was a rare little chink of good news in there. Saying that spending power will increase each year, marginally, not by massive, so don't go and spend it all at once, but a steady and slow bit of income growth there. So those were some of the things that we'd seen in a kind of economic outlook from the OBR. But as you know, we could be looking at a budget later on in the year, and that's all been revised again. So, you know, it is hard. I feel sorry for the people that are working on this independent body that are just having to basically tear up their work within a six-month period. They're probably working on what's going to be for the next predictions for the budget later in the year.
It's extraordinary, but it goes back to the same old thing, is how on earth can you make forecasts like this when we have no idea what is coming ahead, and therefore what is the point in telling us this?
Well, I mean, the OBR, I think you can make a vague forecast. You can't be too precise. The OBR has basically gone for a forecast of pretty much more of the same, but rode back a little bit on some of the optimism, as Lee was just saying there. And we knew that this was going to happen because the Bank of England did this only about a month ago in its inflation report as well. It gave the same outlook that things were going to be a little bit slower, a little bit lower.
So is what's more important the overall picture of what it's saying, which is it's not a disaster. Yes, you can drill it down, like Lee said, into interest rates, the pound, household borrowing. But overall, the picture is, like you said, a bit much of the same, but also probably a little bit more negative, but not wildly negative. Lee talked about house prices there. We're not talking about the 35% drop, worst case scenario, that perhaps Mark Carney was talking about here.
No, and I think that Brexit is a short-term event. He says.
I can't believe
I actually just said that.
In theory.
But you've got to... What they're trying to do is look through that and go, OK, there is a scenario where we might have utter chaos. There is a scenario where we might manage to pull this one off cleanly. This is looking very unlikely at the moment, I should say. Pull this one off cleanly and we get the Brexit bounce. But the most likely scenario is in the middle of that. And it's the middle ground that will shift either slightly towards one end of the spectrum or slightly towards the other. And that's where it's predicting the middle ground. And actually, if you look at some of this stuff, the irony is that things look okay. So we have got the deficit down to 1.1% of GDP. Mm-hmm. Debt is 82.2%, which is pretty spicy. But you've got to bear in mind that we're still dealing with the aftermath of bailing out banks, etc. And that is being whittled away at. We have got wages going up. People are getting more money. And also inflation has come down below 2%. So they are actually genuinely getting more money. We have a scenario whereby house price rises have slowed and are effectively probably going to stall this year or fall slightly into negative territory. But that's quite good because houses are really expensive and they're very difficult for people to buy. And one of the reasons why house prices have slowed is because they have remained very expensive compared to people's wages. So if people's wages are going up by more than house prices, it's still a very big gap, but at least we're trying to squeeze it. And we had this story about the tax burden.
Well, let's get into that now, the true scale of what you call the tax burden on families and businesses, because you're talking about going out to work in record numbers. We're talking about getting an income pay rise. But what's the point if the Exchequer's just stealing it from us all? To the tune, we're talking of over $737 billion this year, up from $700 billion last year. I say stealing it. Obviously, it's for a very good reason. But the overall tax take is equivalent to 34.6% of Britain's economy. And that's not been seen since Wilson was Prime Minister. What's interesting about this, for a number of reasons, is surely that doesn't play very well with the traditional Conservative voter.
No, it doesn't. And you wouldn't think that it would. But I think what you have to bear in mind is that most people see paying tax as part of the social contract, as part of their duty, and that they are willing to pay their fair share. But what they want in return for that is things to be run well.
Well, exactly.
And not to feel
yes.
that their money's being wasted. Yes. And I think one of the reasons why austerity ended up getting so much public support was because people felt they had seen a lot of money wasted. There was obviously a huge expansion of the public sector in the 2000s under the Blair Brown government. There was also a huge expansion in public sector wages, particularly for those at the top. Not for those at the bottom, but for those at the top of the public sector. And so I think that's where some of that support for it came from. Now, it's difficult to square these two things, though, isn't it? Because supposedly we've got austerity just about coming to an end. And we're seeing the effects of it. We're seeing more rough sleeping. We're seeing lots of problems. We're seeing, you know, most people are doing okay, but the people who are on the breadline are really suffering. Yet at the same time, the tax take is as high as it's been since Harold Wilson. So 34.6% of Britain's economy. Under Labour, it peaked at 33.7%. But what's behind this is surging employment, as you said. So basically, because of high employment, low unemployment, the government is raking in lots of money in income tax and national insurance. That is boosting the tax take rather than it having actually put up taxes. There is a scenario where more people are paying higher rate tax because of fiscal drag, but that higher rate tax bracket is going to go up to £50,000, which will reverse some of that. But I read an interesting story today talking about the people earning over £100,000 who are getting hit by the removal of their personal allowance, which basically takes away your personal allowance, £1 for every £2 people earn. So effectively, people in that bracket between 100 and 100, about 123 grand pay 62% tax on every extra pound they earn. And apparently more than 1 million people have been caught by this. Mm. I mean, that's a lot of people ending up paying, you know, such a high rate. Question is, though, it's like we've got our government at the moment is actually taking this much money, but then we have the opposition arguing that they want to come in and take more money off people in tax. So how, I'm not quite sure how you square that.
So Lee, I mean, Simon's raised some really interesting and important issues there.
Yeah.
Obviously, taxes, as we said, for a good reason, you know, we pay our taxes, a social contract we pay.
Yeah.
But it does seem to be in a lot of people I saw complaining on Twitter and social media about council tax rises recently are not seeing that they're getting any improvement. In fact, it's getting worse for what they're paying. Simon talked about homelessness as well. You know, the question, capitalism, is it failing for most people?
The thing is, about the point there about council tax shortages, you know, it's really got a beer mug on it, that, because it's going to go up quite significantly next month, alongside a lot of other household bills that are going to be soaring. Are we getting a better service overall? I would say no. We see stories all the time about councils being run inadequately. People, fundamentally, what it boils down to is bins. That's what people care about. They want a weekly bin service that works, you know. And it sounds ridiculous, but, you know, that's the thing. That's what we're facing up to. We're paying more and more money for a substandard service. And actually looking at how some of these tax burdens are going to hit and the amount of money that's going up. So in the last financial year, for example, income tax rates in $180 billion, that's going to go up to $234 billion in 5 years' time. It's an increase of almost £54 billion. Pounds. National insurance is going up by $35 billion. VAT by $30 billion. Corporation tax by $10 billion. That's a lot of tax going on there. And actually, Matt Kilgoyne of the free market Adam Smith Institute, I thought, summed this up quite nicely in the story you had. He said, the Chancellor is picking the pockets of ordinary workers to fund his deficit reduction targets. His pledge to end public sector austerity will only be welcomed if it doesn't force workers to impose their own personal austerity at home because of higher taxes. I think that's really quite well put. And actually, you know, it doesn't look good, does it, with that percentage?
So what's the solution, Lee?
The solution is that Philip Hammond needs to start having a look at how some of these tax burdens can be reduced for ordinary households. You know, a lot of people do vote Conservative. And as Simon says, people are willing to pay their fair share in tax. But where do you draw the line? And if it keeps nudging higher, but we see our country not doing as well as what we think for those taxes, it starts that balance. Where do people suddenly go, I'm paying too much tax. I'm earning over £100,000 and I'm getting basically, you know, way more than half of my take-home pay disappears before I even see it.
But if we're not getting decent services, Simon, and you then cut the tax burden, where's the money going to come from?
Well, I think Lee put his finger on it there with the quote. And the thing is, most of this money is going to try and cut our deficit and reduce our debt. And the argument that has been put forward is that we should slow that down, that we should be spending more of the money rather than using it to pay down the debt and to try and squeeze the deficit to as low as possible. So the deficit is due to fall to just 0.5% in about 5 years' time, and divert some of that money into places where it is needed. And I will defend councils here slightly in the council tax issue, is that we have had a council tax freeze for a long time, and councils are really strapped for cash. That's why they keep doing things that really annoy people, like cutting various services. And I think that maybe there is an argument that says we have got to the point where we need to start diverting some of that money away from trying to balance the books and back into society. But that's a difficult one, because actually the idea of balancing the books sounds quite appealing, doesn't it?
But how long have we been talking about balancing the books, though, and the deficit coming down to 0.5%? I just feel like...
A decade, I believe. And
it's just like, are we going to get further down the road? And it still hasn't got to a percentage point in which we're happy with.
And this is the problem, is effectively when you take on debt, or when you use debt to finance your lifestyle or your spending, you are borrowing from the future. Yeah. And what we did was we borrowed from the future, and now it means that if you borrow from the future, you can't have quite as much in the future. And unfortunately, that's what we are now suffering.
But also with Brexit, can we have this debate even now anyway? Is this now a time to be looking at sort of root and branch issues of... Simon, you look really confused.
I thought we were getting a Brexit dividend. We can have loads of money spent.
That's true. Now's a great time to talk about all that extra money we'll have.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds. Now you can start saving from just £25. Millions of tax-free prizes every month.
Now, one extremely unpopular and rather distasteful tax has actually been rumbled by the government's own watchdog, thanks to the eagle eye of This Is Money. Simon, you've been criticising a hike in probate tax since it was first proposed 2 years ago. The plan would have seen the cost for some bereaved families rise from £125 to £6,000. But the government looked to get it waved through without a vote or a debate in Parliament, which they would have had to, by classifying it instead as a fee and not a tax. Well, the OBR, well, they disagreed with that, and in the spring statement documents, they called it a tax.
Yes, Simon, not tax, though.
You wrote about
okay,
this.
Just to be clear, it's not a tax.
It's a fee, apparently.
So probate fees have been around for a long time. When someone dies and you have to basically do their estate, the executors, in order to get that rubber stamped, have to pay a probate fee. £215 flat fee. The government first suggested doing this in, I think, 2017, and it wanted to actually whack up probate fees by even more and banned them, depending on the size of the estate. And so the original plan was to push it up for the biggest estates. The cost was going to be £20,000. I mean, it's some jump to go from 215 to 20,000, a 9,200% jump, I should say. This then got sort of derailed by the election that Theresa May called, the snap election. There wasn't enough time to get a load of stuff through. And people thought that what would happen was, because of the outrage over this, and bear in mind they did a consultation on this, mm-hmm. the consultation was not one that the general public tended to answer, because the general public doesn't tend to indulge in consultations on probate fees, but it was mainly answered by people in the industry, the accounting industry, stuff like that, solicitors and people. There was such a huge groundswell of support for raising probate fees that a whole 2% said it was a good idea. Nonetheless, the wow. government decided to push on with its plan until, as I said, it was derailed by the election, at which point everyone thought that they might just quietly bury this one in the pile marked bad ideas that we'll hope people forgot we ever had. But no, they came back with it. They came back with what they believed was a much more palatable increase of only 2,700% for the most expensive estates, so up to a maximum of £6,000. Now, the way that they wanted to try and get away with this was by pushing it through Parliament as a fee, because originally it was a fee, but it was pointed out to them that they were now taking so much money off people and it was so disproportionate to the service that they were getting that this could not be classified as a fee, and this was in fact now a tax, which was a bit rich for a government that had already lambasted its Labour opposition with accusations that the Labour opposition wanted to bring in a death tax, and this is what it was effectively being accused of doing, particularly as we already have an inheritance tax anyway, which is 40% on money of above a certain level. Then anyway, they got this one through Parliament on the basis that it was a fee. And then lo and behold, in the OBR document, the OBR says that it's not, says it's a tax. So in it, it said basically, the Treasury expects the ONS to classify the new structure with its 2,700% increase in cost for estates valued over £2 million as a tax in the national accounts. The OBR also revealed it would rake in £155 million a year in additional tax receipts from this, which would be hefty enough to distort behaviour and actually drag down inheritance tax receipts by £5 million, due to the incentive for individuals with estates worth closer to the thresholds in the new probate fee structure to reduce the value of their estates, brackets, through genuine or contrived means to pay a lower fee. Brilliantly, after we wrote the story on this on Wednesday afternoon, the Ministry of Justice, which is the people mm-hmm. who will collect said not a tax, it's a fee, put out a statement in which it stuck to its guns. Bizarrely, it claimed that even if something is officially claimed as a tax, that doesn't mean it is a tax and it can still be a fee. Oh. And in the interest of balance, I will read out the quote from the MOJ. This is not a tax. And any decision by the ONS to define it as such would be purely for accounting purposes. The income raised from probate fees will go towards funding a more efficient and effective courts and tribunal system. I mean, look, you can probably trace all of this back to the fact that they don't have enough money to run the court system due to austerity, etc. So now they've decided to pick people's pockets another way. Whatever, whichever way you look at it, I think it's pretty disgraceful to be effectively trying to rinse the bereaved.
Yeah.
And I don't know why they didn't just back down on this one when they had the chance. I don't know why they're trying to push it through. And I don't know why they're still trying to maintain that it's not a tax when their own budget watchdog and the Office of National Statistics yeah. says it's a tax.
And this is the problem with tax, I think. If people understand where it's going and they trust the system, etc., etc., I think people will be happy to pay. But the fact that they're coming out and fudging it now is actually just quite embarrassing. But it's also targeting a group of people that, well, you're not going to have to deal with it until you get to that awful moment.
It's just about the sneakiest yeah. tax rise you could bring in, yeah.
Lee, you were laughing, not in a humorous way. You were doing the money sign.
Yeah, I was laughing because it feels like it's something straight out of a script from the thick of it. I mean, it's absolutely incredible that they've pushed it through and saying it's not a tax, but then other government departments and other independent places are saying, well, it is a tax. It's all got it's got very, very, very muddy. I would not be surprised if this gets a further look at in more detail, because I was laughing there sheerly out of embarrassment for the government of how sneaky and how disgusting that this move is. I mean, as Simon said, inheritance tax is already pretty meaty for a lot of people that fall into the brackets. To add on this further insult for me to the bereaved, this does not smack of a conservative move to me.
Strange, isn't it? Lots of things like that.
I mean, like, just to put this into perspective, right? Yes, this £6,000 fee will only affect estates over £2 million, right? There's a lot of money there. But if you leave an estate worth £2 million to someone other than your spouse, at which point there is no inheritance tax to pay, but your spouse will still get hit with the £6,000 for going thadonk rubber stamp on the probate forms. But if you leave it to someone else, okay, even allowing for this new own home allowance on top of inheritance tax, you benefit from that takes you up to £1 million. £1 million of that £2 million estate will have had inheritance tax levied on it. So that estate will have paid £400,000 in inheritance tax. I know, let's hit them for another six. I mean, it doesn't matter whether those people are rich or not. That's just not right. It's just not the right way to behave. And it just mystifies me why people in charge of the country think that it's a good idea to do this and bring down
money
on them.
Simon,
Why pick arguments that there's no point in picking and you're only going to get lambasted for? Do they need the bother?
No,
I think they've got enough on their plate at the moment, haven't they?
I know. But you know, it does. It shows a slightly desperate kind of any which way we can sneak things through, which is why people don't like tax.
Yeah,
I think you hit
the nail on the head there. It looks desperate.
Another government fail that we're going to talk about, according to the OBR. Not one, but two of its saving schemes, the LISA and Help to Save. Now, last week I was talking about how my LISA makes me a little bit nervous, you know, especially coming towards the end of the tax year. Do I fill it ahead of perhaps something else? Would the money be better used elsewhere? Now, the LISA has been heavily criticised. There was even a call last July, by the Treasury Select Committee for it to be scrapped, blaming their, quote, perverse incentives and complexity. It seems like people have been listening. They've shied away from opening one. So firstly, we'll go to the LISA. Lee, what the OBR saying? What are these figures showing?
So, yes, buried in this OBR document was the fact that the lifetime ISA has really relatively been a flop. And that's pretty good news, really, for the taxpayer, because what happened was, when this got launched, it was one of those real rabbits we were talking about earlier in the 2016 budget to attract sort of really younger savers and giving them an incentive to save. And what you can do is you can put up to £4,000 a year into one of these and get a £1,000 government bonus, effectively a 25% uplift each year. Now, the reason why the Treasury Select Committee and we have been pretty critical of these products is the fact that it's aimed towards saving towards two very different goals, as we've mentioned previously on this podcast numerous times. You can either use it to put towards a first-time buyer to a property, or you have to wait till you're 60 to access the cash. It's very confusing. Pension or property, it's not very good way in which to market a product anyway. What we say is that if you're looking to buy a home, definitely worth going for, if you know you are going to probably buy a house within the next 5 years. Now, what we spotted in this OBR document was that in 2016, it estimated by 2021, it was going to be costing £845 million a year. It's a sizable old chunk of cash, that. And what that cash is the government bonus. So how many bonuses it would have been expected to pay out. If more than half that, they're saying it's going to be more like £420 million. Now, the big issue and the big problem and the big reason for that is that there's so few providers that actually offer a lifetime ISA. What it really needed was, probably before it launched, a couple of big banks to say, yeah, we'll take this on and we'll go for it and we'll run with it. But the appetite has been low amongst providers. We've got a handful of building societies that offer them. And for that reason, it just hasn't picked up as much as what the government expected. That might even get revised down further. And it shows the lack of appetite there's been for this product. And what the OBR actually said was that the product has fallen short of expectations. That was the exact wording in there. And now another savings scheme, this was David Cameron's favourite little baby, this one, Help to Save. What it is lower income workers, so people who are on working tax credits or those who claim universal credit that have a household income of more than £542 a month could open up one of these Help to Save accounts. And they can put in, it's meant to be like a rainy day fund. So they could pay in 50 quid a month and the government will top up 50p for every pound put in, right? So over 4 years, if you maxed it out, you get £1,200 of free government cash. And it was an incentive to help those on lower incomes build up a savings pot, essentially. So the idea was the kind of right thing, you know, because people do struggle to save and it's good to incentivize those that wouldn't ordinarily save to do so. However, this also looks like it's going to be a pretty big flop. So it was expecting almost 200,000 people to have opened these accounts by April. But we've had figures that actually 90,000 have opened it up. And again, there's going to be half, or it's going to cost half what they initially predicted because they won't be paying out as many bonuses as they anticipated.
So what's going to happen with these, do you reckon? So are they going to scrap them? And if they do, what happens to those people who've got them?
I think at some point we are going to see a bonfire of these things, whether it's this government or the next government that comes in. I think we will see a bonfire of these things, or just a massive consolidation. There's a big push, for example, to try and tidy up the ISA system and put it all under one umbrella. There was this idea of the Everything ISA that was raised by this working party group, which was good news to me, as I discussed on last week's podcast, because prior to that, I've said a similar thing, that we should just have it all attached to our national insurance number. Mm-hmm. You've got your allowance, you can put your money into as many ISAs as you want. But I think we probably need to thin down the number of them. I think we've probably seen the end of Help Twos being launched. I don't think we'll see any more Help Twos being launched. But I think that those who've already got the products will probably be pretty safe and be able to continue saving money into them.
With the same benefits? Because the problem is it's
so
difficult.
That's where you're
going to
see the issues is whether these benefits continue to be able to be accrued. Because, for example, if you've opened a lifetime ISA, you have to be under 40 to open one of these. Mm-hmm. But any money that you put in, you should get the government bonus until you're 50. So that means that if you're a 25-year-old and you've opened one of these, you should have 25 years worth of bonuses coming up. Will the government stick to that? Will the next government stick to that, even if they shutter it? Who knows? I would expect that they would do, because otherwise there's going to be uproar and the suggestion that people have been missold this product in some way. Probably not an issue for those who are using it for a pension, because you could just say to those people, well, look, we're just going to ship you into the pension system and you get the same tax relief on that mm-hmm. as the one you've been promised on the lifetime ISA. Big problem for anyone using it to save for a home deposit. And that's where I actually think the real winner of having a lifetime ISA is, for saving for a home deposit.
Mm-hmm. I just want to know, Lee, in terms of the savings, general savings figures at the moment, do these stats show anything about our appetite, particularly among millennials, my favourite expression, to save generally? Or is it just we don't like these? There just aren't enough ISAs around? Is there anything that we can link the two together?
I don't think it really gives you a snapshot of how the ability or willingness of people to save.
Yeah.
I think what it shows is that there's been a lack of appetite, firstly for the lifetime ISA, because of, you know, it is quite confusing for people. It is a product in which if you don't buy a first time home with it, essentially you'd be better off just paying more into your pension if you've got that spare cash. So I think people have been put off by it, and as I said earlier, there's been such a lack of appetite from providers to offer these. If there was a big high street bank or a couple of big high street banks or you know, a Nationwide or something like that, they'd actually come out and really sort of decided to get involved with it, I think we would have seen a much bigger uptake of people getting involved. But I think it's been in the press, it's been a little bit sort of blasted. You know, we had that Treasury Select Committee last year saying that actually, you know, it is complex. So people have been put off. I think that people are looking at other ways to save rather than not saving whatsoever. And as I say, that Help to Save product, it was created with the right intentions. I think that they were a bit optimistic as to how many people can actually really afford to squirrel away any kind of cash a month. You know, lower income households, it's not easy to find 50 quid a month to tuck away. You know, people are struggling, as I mentioned earlier in the show. Bills are going up. You know, feel like there's as big a squeeze as there's ever been. So I don't think it really gives you too much of an indication. I think it's more that these products have just flopped somewhat.
Okay, let's move on from that. And the story that got my mum this week. Boilers. Also in the spring statement was the announcement that new gas boilers are to be banned for new homes from 2025. Now, it's thought the move, help climate change and all that, could add £5,000 on to the average price of buying a home. Okay. Great. Climate change. Yeah, we like that.
Don't like climate change. Yeah, yeah.
No, anything, no, we don't like climate change.
We don't like climate change.
That's the point. Anything to help the environment.
Get with the programme. You're not Donald Trump.
Sorry. Apologies. Backtrack. We like things to help the environment, but we also like warm homes and hot water. So... I could be wrong here. What is going...
You're only saying that because your boiler didn't work for ages, aren't you?
My boiler didn't work for 3 weeks. And so I appreciate, thank you very much to my local Pilates studio for unwittingly helping me out on that one. Didn't do much about the cold, though. What are they replacing this with?
New things.
Okay, great.
It's just not entirely clear what the new things
are. Tell us more about this plan. Yes, exactly.
Okay, the government have not specified exactly what will replace the traditional boiler. And there are concerns about how long high-tech, low-carbon heaters can take to warm a room and cost implications for taxpayers. This is what the naysayers have to say about this. Ground source heat pumps are one of the ideas. These extract heat from the outside air, even in the depths of winter, channel it into a compressor that amplifies the heat, which is then used to warm up water for the heating, taps and showers. Pumps are generally combined with extra insulation. However, the total cost of these two elements and new property is currently estimated to be around £5,000 more expensive than a gas boiler. They have other drawbacks, such as being noisy, requiring a highly insulated home to see any benefits, are less efficient in winter and require electricity. Other things that could be used, utilising local heat works, which is a system of insulated pipes that takes heat from a central source and delivers it to a building. These can require a large amount of capital expenditure. Replacing natural gas with hydrogen, but fitting a range of boilers to replace traditional ones could also have a huge cost implication. And yeah, as I said, also ground source heat pumps are something that have been used previously. That's drawing heat from the ground. Now, all of these things work.
Right.
They're just expensive and they're new technologies, and house builders who have not exactly bathed themselves in glory in recent years for the quality of the homes that they are building would be expected to be introducing these things rather than the thing that they are very, very used to delivering, which is gas central heating. I mean, I guess most people's concern is that what this would lead to is having to have some form of electric central heating, which actually tends to be more expensive. Interestingly, there is the option of green gas or biomethane created from biodegradable material such as food and farm waste, purified and pumped into the pipes for cooking and heating. A number of advocates of this, including Prince Charles, who has a digester at Poundbury, his model village in Dorset, which pumps gas and electricity into the national grid network to power homes and businesses. But vegans have raised ethical concerns. It might not be compatible with veganism.
Okay.
Due to the use of animal waste.
Okay. So it seems to me that we don't have a really, really clear plan. I could be wrong. This is happening very soon. 2025 is not that far away. And we don't have a clear plan. Is that what Simon's been saying?
Yes, I think that's a good conclusion there, Georgie.
Right.
Yeah, they want this to happen within 6 years, but we're not sure how it's going to happen. And Simon and I actually had a real sort of in-depth chat about this yesterday. We had a real good boiler chat, didn't we, Simon? Around the desk talking about what could actually be used to replace boilers and what actually that means for the average person. Now, we were talking about, if you were going to put one of these systems into a home that's already been built and that you live in, you'd have to basically tear up the house to manage to put one of these in. So it shows you that the level of when you're putting it into a new build, the amount of complexity there is compared to just putting in a boiler and connecting it to the gas mains. I have a feeling that 2025 is going to be a little bit optimistic to roll this out if they haven't even really thought about what they want in these new builds.
Yeah.
As Simon rightly said, I think the big issue is that house builders really, their number one priority is profits.
Yeah.
So I'll be interested to see how the quality control goes on these new builds when finally this does happen, if it does happen.
I just think government rollouts of new technology has, well...
Not smooth running.
No, yeah. Smart meters, anybody. But anyway, in the environment, so we'll stick to that theme for our final piece here. Are we heading for a solar panel eclipse? Now, the good feed-in tariff payouts are going to be scrapped for new customers from March the 31st with nothing to replace them. So just a quick one there, Simon, what's happening?
Solar panels. huge success, actually, the solar panel system of trying to get more households to fit solar panels. And what incentivized that was some juicy payouts that you could get, particularly if you signed up near the beginning of this, round about 2010, which is a surprisingly long time ago now. And you got two things from feed-in tariffs. You got something called the generation tariff, where you got paid for every unit of electricity, kilowatt hour unit of electricity that you generated. And you got the export tariff, which is where you got paid for every unit that you exported back to the grid. Now, at one point, people were being paid about 40p per unit that they generated. And the return on that, based on the cost of panels, was about 10 or 12% a year. It was inflation linked for 25 years, so it will have gone up since then. And then the export tariff was about 3p. So if you were wealthy enough to be able to go out and buy some panels, you could be quids in. And this was actually a pretty decent thing to do with your money. And lots of our quite financially savvy readers decided that this was a good place to invest some of their cash into and have earned some handsome returns. What you also got was a bit of a Wild West scenario because the government didn't quite think it through. And you then ended up with lots of companies who were basically cold calling people about seven times a day, offering to put solar panels on their roof, which they wouldn't have to pay for, in return for which the company would pick up the feed-in tariff payments and the person would get some free electricity. The problem was, effectively, they were renting your roof. There was a big row about this. There's people have got... You were effectively signing up to allow a company to rent your roof for 25 years and you got free electricity in return for it. Problem is, of course, is what if you want to move home and the next person doesn't want this? Yep. Anyway, government cracked down on it, tried to stop these tariffs. But also, because the price of panels started falling, they started pulling down the feed-in tariffs to try and reflect it. But then they cut the return substantially because the concern was that everybody else was paying for this on their energy bills in order to subsidise wealthier people who were getting solar panels and getting a very good deal from it. Short story ended 31st of March. Feed-in tariffs stop. If you get solar panels fitted after that point, you will no longer get the returns. Those people who'd already signed up, already got them registered for that date, will continue to get the returns they were promised. Slight problem is now people think that people won't put solar panels on their roofs because, according to the Energy Saving Trust, if you were in all day, you would expect to make an energy saving from solar panels of £210 a year. If you were out until 6pm each day, which is people out of work, you'd only expect to get about £90 a year. Work that back on the cost of the panels and you're getting about a 3.3% return if you're in all day, or a 1.45% return if you're out all day. Most people are going to think that they're not going to get the money back from the panels. So there is an idea that they might bring in something to replace the feed-in tariffs. Unfortunately, going back to our boiler story, we don't know what that is yet. Just to say 31st of March. Yeah, that is the 31st of March 2019, the one that is coming up quite soon.
Again, loads of time, though.
Loads of time. Hey, look, why would you need to actually tell loads people what you're going to replace it with?
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, the great thing about solar panels is we now generate loads of renewable energy in this country. Solar panels have been a huge success. So has wind energy, offshore wind energy as well. At some points, basically, over the past year, we have generated more than 50% of the electricity being used from renewable sources. That is really important for trying to do something to combat climate change. But we've got ourselves into a little bit of a pickle with the system now.
Just a quick figures here. It's so far, that feed-in tariff has cost £6 billion of public money. And before the end of the payments, it's going to have cost £30 billion. The solar uptake was underestimated by the government by 100,000 households, and it means now the average energy bill, you pay an extra £14 on your energy bill as a result to pay for this.
£14 on your energy bill, though, to fight possibly the biggest risk to our children and our children's children, which is climate change, I don't necessarily think is that bad. But it has, the benefits have accrued to those with the money to buy the panels, one of whom is our own columnist Tony Hazel,
yes,
who writes the Ask Tony column and is a huge fan of his solar panels, but says on the current rate of return, he probably wouldn't get them now. Another person who's done very well out of it is my father-in-law, who's got them on his house in Shropshire and is extremely pleased with the return he's had on his money, but also extremely pleased with the fact that he's generating lots of green energy.
Well, if you are one of those people who've also benefited, or you've got anything you'd like to comment on, please do get in contact, Simon.
Tweet us at This Is Money. email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk if you've got a problem you want us to solve, or you've got a good story about probate fees, or you want to tell us about your solar panels and the returns you've had, because actually it'd be really good to get some people who've actually got these, more people who've actually got these to write about. And come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast, where you can argue about the merits of solar panels, probate fees, and all other things to your heart's content in the reader comments.
You can indeed. You stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. For a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little. Give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.